We covered a lot last week, and again, I want to thank the team that put this all together. It's a scramble every week right now to try to get this together. There's just so much information. This week, for instance, we will cover about 550 years, something like that. A little over 500 years.
Last week was 1.6 million years.
Last year was 1.6 million years. So we're narrowing it down.
Next week is 50 years.
Yeah.
Oh.
And
so
next week is 50 years.
Yeah.
And yet, human societies keep becoming more and more complex. So this week was even more difficult to narrow down. So we are desperately trying to narrow it down to 2 pages. 10-point font.
We just make the font smaller.
Yeah. But, to be fair, same size font as last week. But before we start, we want to just see... thanks again to Marie for the delicious meal.
Woo! Marie!
Any thoughts or questions or comments from last week, just to jog our memory? And I think John will do a little bit of...
We are going to do a summary.
We'll do a little review.
There'll be a little bit of review.
Just comments, what are people thinking about?
Yeah. What are you thinking about?
A baby. Sorry.
Sebastian! He's a cutie pie. Yes, Tom.
I really like the part of the story that shows there's like personal God, and then there's the larger God when the kings sort of take over the religion.
Right.
I think that seems very valuable and important.
So. So the big tradition, little tradition.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
I've heard it more, I almost thought it was Old Testament, New Testament, but that's not true.
Oh, no,
so.
Yeah. Susie?
Just how we were talking about, like, in the beginning, everybody just took what they needed, and there was no hoarding of resources.
Yes.
And that that God's will for us is kind of minimalism, that it's to take what we need and not too much.
Right. And even Jesus in the Lord's Supper, you know, just shared a simple meal. When Jesus is resurrected, you know, Jesus shares a simple meal. And very reminiscent of God provides our daily bread, the manna, and you can collect double on the day before Sabbath, but not any more than that. And when you do, it rots. So, and then Jesus talks in his ministry about how our wealth rots, whereas the things that are of the kingdom does not. So, yes. Other thoughts or questions or from last week? Yeah, what was new or kind of some kind of shift that we were able to make through last week?
I think it was interesting, like the cycle that people would the kingdom would grow, and then the kingdom would lose power because of how big it was, and it would collapse again on itself, and people will scatter, and then they'll find their old traditions again. But then as time goes by, again the kingdom will come up, and then again they will use God as an excuse to, you know, just suppress the people and oppress the people and stuff, and then as it grows bigger and bigger, they will revolt, and then they lose power again. And it's like a very gradual cycle, but it's like a cycle.
So
summarizing all 4 weeks.
So society keeps getting top heavy with the elites controlling more and more resources, and then the whole society collapses on the weight of its own unjust elitism. Not anything that happens today. But in the old days, the evil old days. Very good. Anything else? Lori?
I guess looking back, you know, and kind of rereading Genesis and like thinking about imagining these groups of people trying to come up with a common story and common, like, you know, set of agreements to live a different way just brings in different meaning and beauty to the stories.
I am actually accompanying a musical, Joseph. And
you're accompanying in a musical called Joseph.
Yeah.
About
amazing technical.
Oh, is that the Andrew Lloyd Webber?
Yes.
Okay.
And then there's a word, a canon, and I didn't know what it is, and I learned it last week.
Yeah, I'm like, what the heck?
I've sat through many, many Old Testament survey type sessions, and it just was very different. It just from a different perspective.
Like Minnesotan different, or
it made it actually more real and like about people and. I love what Susie, thank you for reminding me that, you know, that they were sharing, and that's how God laid it out. And I thought about the Ten Commandments and the law, and just like, it was for how to get along. And so some people just like, today, we've got to obey the law, we got to obey the law. Well, that's not it. It's how to care and get along.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just really good.
Josiah.
Yeah, to piggyback on that, like
King Josiah.
So that was definitely a little But to piggyback off what Nancy said, that's exactly kind of my Old Testament classes at Northwestern were very much it's like a rushed semester to create context for penal substitutionary atonement.
Oh my gosh.
And all it is like rushing through history to like say, well, this is all the way it was, and then Jesus came along, and then this is why this is important, but a totally different interpretation.
Mm. Mm-hmm. That's great.
Toussaint. I've learned that our relationship to the land is everything, because everything that we use, we eat, everything comes from the land. And even ourselves become like from dust we were made, and to dust we shall return, and everything. So I understood that the laws, I mean, the way we relate to the land is really important.
Did people hear this?
Yeah.
Toussaint said what he learned last week is that our relationship to the land is everything, and that from dust we came and to dust we shall return is just. It's not just a saying, but something profound about who we are and our relationship to God and God's creation. All right. Excellent reflections. Before we start this session, I want to point to this poster right here, Who We Are. You've all seen it. Some of you even decided to join our church based on this. That's really the question that the Jews are struggling with. Who are we with each succeeding era. Okay, now that the Babylonians are our masters, our temporal masters on this earth, who are we now? Now that we've been liberated kind of by the Persians, but now under Persian domination, who are we now? What does it mean to be the people of God now? So who we are is the question they're struggling with, and the biblical witness, the Bible records that struggle, that really hard fought struggle for people to figure out who they are. And there's typically at least two versions, but a dominant version is the elites deciding who we are, and then the common people trying to reclaim who we think we are. So we're going to see that contest play out again this week. So do be attentive to that. And did everyone get this handout, or will we pass it out now? And you'll see that there's four sessions today, and at the end of each session is who are we now, right? And that is what will tie our whole discussion together today, is at the end of each of these eras in these 500 years, who are we now?
So you have, there's also a few handouts from last week, if anyone didn't get that. We have a couple of those here. Also, so great to see so many people back and have Bentley and Bree with us this week. Thanks for jumping in. All right. So the first page you have is the sort of outline of what we're covering today. It's front and back. It's like what we handed out last time, just covering this week's class. And then the second page is, I think somebody suggested this last week. It's a kind of a timeline of some of the major events that we're talking about by year. It's a summary of last week, so you can see where we came from, and a summary of this week. So it's just some basic historical points throughout, in case you feel like you're kind of losing your place and want to find out where we are in the story. It's kind of an at-a-glance version. So that's what this page is. But what we'll be following along during the class is this main outline on the front page. And you don't have to follow along with it while we go. It's mostly for your notes, but of course you're free to.
Does anybody else need one from last week?
So our class today, what we're going to do is John's going to give a quick summary of last week so we can just kind of get ourselves back into the story, kind of jog our memory to where we were and where we've been. He's going to do that quickly. and then I'm going to pull up some of the slides from last week too, so we can just kind of remember where we were. Again, we'll go until 8:30 and then we'll have an optional discussion for anyone who wants to stick around. And again, just a reminder that we also have two crosstalk spaces to do that coming up too, on February 12th and 19th. So, there's a lot of big things that we're talking about, and so we want to make as much space as we can to process that. And as we said before, you're welcome to, have a one-on-one conversation too with me or John or Dana or Isaac or Pastor Jen who put this together. All of us are happy to do that. And just one note that I'll say about that. I was talking to someone this week about they were meeting with a pastor friend who has a very professionalized kind of role in their church, and she was talking about this conversation that they were having and saying how he really just kind of does what he does because it's a job and doesn't actually really connect with the faith. And I was thinking how different that was in our church, and that all the people who put this together to really connect with us in a deep and meaningful way, as I think all of you do too. And so we're really lucky to have, I think, such passionate people, all of you, and our elders and our deacons and staff too, who really believe in the faith, even if it's a little bit different than maybe what we grew up hearing. But there's still something very deep and very, very meaningful in here. So feel free to have clarifying conversations or just reflective conversations with yourselves or with any of us. Also, thanks to Claire Kim, who I don't think is here, we will have cookies during our break. Yes. Okay, so I'll hand it over to John.
Oh, and Nora, would you say a prayer for us real quick?
Sure.
We can't learn this stuff without the Holy Spirit. This is really tough stuff.
Okay. Oh, gracious God, we thank you so much for your presence among us. We thank you for bringing us together as a family and as a community, and for your word. Which is powerful and deep, and maybe even more so than we ever knew. Just ask that you would give us ears to hear and eyes to see things that have been obscured. Help us to have faith that is strong and rooted and grounded, and to carry us through hard times. For all your gifts, including one another, we give you thanks and praise and our love. In Jesus' name.
Amen. Amen.
Can everybody get tonight's handout? I am really amazed that we have this many people coming out for a Bible survey on a Wednesday night.
Well,
that
was a breaker.
Yeah. And the people came back, so that's good too.
Food.
I'm also sure for a lot of us, and I know this is a lot of the impulse behind this series, is that we're seeing Christianity be used all kinds of ways right now, and the Bible being so abused. And we also have a very deep sense that the Bible has a lot to say for us in this time and place, and it can be hard to sift through all that. And I'm just reminded again as I go through all this that the arguments and the struggles and the tensions that we're feeling today is not all that different from what we're engaging here. As Pastor Jen said, this text is it's an internal argument over who God is, who the people of God are called to be. We've inherited a tradition of reading the Bible that tends to flatten it, and it has a certain, I'm glad you mentioned, Josiah, penal substitutionary atonement, a certain theological understanding of Jesus dying for our sins that personalizes it, individualizes it, abstracts it, and then the whole Old Testament is just there to point to Jesus in some way. But aside from that, it can be hard to know what to do with it. And so we're kind of embarrassed by it because there's a lot of awful stuff in the Old Testament too. So, and we've seen it so abused. So we have to figure out what to do with that. And unfortunately, what we end up doing is taking away the Jewishness from Jesus and taking away his location and his political, economic context as well. So we strip all that, and we just abstract him, and then we can make Jesus into whatever we want him to be. And then we get the sort of Christianity that we're seeing that can support the rise of a figure like Trump. So we're trying to undo all that. We're trying to understand, first of all, the context, and that is the what does it mean to say Jesus is a first century Palestinian Jew? And he was always a first century Palestinian Jew. Jesus was not Christian. He was Jewish. That comes later. So we're trying to get and understand that. And for Jesus to be in that place means that he enters into a tradition that has been wrestling internally and having a lot of arguments now for 1,000+ years and has been grappling with foreign empires for most of that time too. So that's what we're trying to get, because if we can start to get that, I know this is my experience and a lot of others, then the Gospels opens up in a whole new and much deeper way and becomes more relevant than ever. And then this really becomes exciting and good news again. So I'll start there. And just to echo what others have said, Laura has done this PowerPoint, which is just a wonderful tool. And Isaac and Dana have done so much in terms of just thinking this all through. And so this is just kind of a culmination of a lot of stuff we've been processing and talking about, and Pastor Jim too. So, all right, last week, glad to hear some of your comments. I'm just going to highlight four key things from last week, the four things in the outline, just because these are things that we're going to keep coming back to, and you'll hear it again today too. So the first point is I started with the rise of agriculture, which in a span of 1.6 million years is a pretty recent time span. We're talking 10,000 years out of 1.6 million years of humans on this earth. And it was it happened in the Fertile Crescent, in the area that we're in. And so there you have the Fertile Crescent, the eastern side of the Mediterranean. In the north, Mesopotamia, the south, Egypt. With agriculture, eventually, this takes several thousand years, but eventually you get centralization. People settle, they can develop they can store food, which is a surplus, and then they got to protect it. So then they build walls and have police and cities and all that stuff. So eventually you get the rise of cities. With cities come kings, and with kings comes extraction, taxation, trying to bring everything from the periphery into the center. Okay? So that's the dynamic that is fast intensifying. It really started around 4000 BCE when you have the rise of Sumer, Akkad, some of those early cities up in the north, and then in the south you start to have the Egyptian empires around 3000 and following. So we enter, this is important because right in the middle of this location, going back to the Fertile Crescent, we have Palestine, and you can't pass through here, through the desert. It's very difficult, and a lot of work to go through here, through the Mediterranean Sea. So there's two routes to get through here. So this is a really, really critical piece of land in Palestine, highly contested, and so it's just like, it's right at the center of all this that's happening. So basically, agriculture messes things up, and the early Canaanites are located right in the middle of that, and there's a few people that at the end of, as the Egyptian Empire is starting to break apart a bit, it's starting to weaken, that are able to escape from these Egyptian city-states along Palestine, and they go up into the highlands. So that's point two. Point one is the rise of agriculture. Point two is that there are some people that try to retreat. We have a lot of archaeological evidence of all these villages that just took off up in the highlands. Highlands are right here. They get away from some of the city-states. And then they're just struggling with, okay, that was really awful for us. So we don't want that. So how do we maybe go back into some of our ancient history, retrieve some of our oral traditions, and try to remember a different way? So they bring together some of these stories. A lot of those stories we have in Genesis 12 to 50. And then the key story, the one that kind of brings it all together for them, is the Sinai tradition, the Exodus, Moses and the people's retreat from Egypt. And in that, in the God Yahweh of this tradition, the people really come together and form a covenant, start to, a really critical thing of this is their economics. Rather than a transactional economy, heavy taxation and all that, and indebtedness, they start to experiment with Jubilee, but it's more of like a village relational economy. A lot of mutual aid, hospitality becomes really critical, trying to relate outside of these imperial economies that have emerged around. And then so the covenant becomes a really critical part of this, and Nancy, you mentioned that the law, the covenant, all of this is just like local guidelines for how to live well together. So a little different than maybe what we're used to in terms of this kind of universal norm and law that we get in the West. You know, it becomes all that, and the kind of the hardness of the Ten Commandments. Here, it's just, we got to think through, like, how to live well together. And we got to have some norms or some guidelines to do that. So that's point two. Point three, you have foreign imperial threats that are still present. It's amazing that they were able to do this experiment from about 1250 to 1050 for a couple hundred years. But the Philistines, related to the Sea Peoples, were always present down there for about 100 years were present to the south. And eventually there starts to be a greater tension emerging, and the Philistines are looking to encroach more and more upon the Israelite territory. And so with that, they need to centralize for defense. So Saul is early in that process. He's more of a chieftain, just kind of a military commander. David furthers that process by locating Jerusalem as the sacred city and starting putting a shrine there and bringing people around. And then Solomon is the one that really leads the people into it fully. Solomon builds the temple, builds his palace, he redraws lines. So all their former kind of village arrangements and stuff, all that gets broken up, he redistricts, and he does it for the purpose of more efficient taxation and also conscripting people for labor. So this is all for building the temple. So Solomon leads the people now much further into the very thing they were trying to retreat from earlier. That is, with every city, you have a temple. It's just one of the first things that you have because it provides the ideological justification for the rule. It says that this is willed by the gods. And in fact, the temple then becomes the place where the money, taxation, all of that kind of occurs through. And the high priests were often those who collected the taxes. So they now have a temple, and they have a big army that emerges. The kingdom splits because he overreaches. Now you have the north, and you have the south. The north lasts a couple hundred more years, 922 to 722, until they're conquered by Assyria. And then the south, they last a little bit longer. They're located in Jerusalem. They're very suspicious of... They start to really crack down in the north, especially Josiah's reforms. He's a king in the south. And I said that the book of Joshua is, a lot of evidence points to it being written as one of the ways to justify all Josiah's reforms. Shutting down all the local sites of worship, centralizing everything in the temple, and all the conquest narratives of Joshua is also kind of a threat to the people that they need to follow this. Leads it right from Exodus into conquest and into centralization around this book of the law that has been found, Josiah comes. So that's where we're at. And then in 587, and you have a timeline that's been printed off. In 587, down here, yep. This brings us up to today, coping with empire. So this is what we're going to be focusing on today. Coping with the Babylonian Empire, coping with the Persian Empire, the Greek Empire, and then a brief period of kind of semi-independent rule that we'll talk about at the end. So the question that we'll keep on asking throughout, and Pastor Jan already highlighted that, is who are we now? In every one of these periods, the people have to step back and wrestle with what does it mean to follow the tradition? What is the tradition? Who is God? Who is Yahweh calling us to be? And there are a lot of different perspectives on that. And we're entering now into the Babylonian exile that I'll talk some about. And so can you go back with you, Laura? Mm-hmm. And so can we maintain our values overall now, the big question, after being assaulted by Babylon, and then by Persia, and then by Greece, and then by our own Hasmonean dynasty? This is the ongoing question. Okay, So this brings us up to today. If you look at your handout, the Babylonian exile. The Babylonian exile, actually in 598, I think, was the first time that some people were deported from Babylon, including the prophet Jeremiah. So Jeremiah had been mourning and grieving and weeping about the impending exile, but kind of counseled the people that this is coming and we've kind of brought this on ourselves. Jeremiah gets exiled to Egypt. But in 587 is the major dispersal. Babylon comes in, conquers Jerusalem, destroys the temple, raises all the walls. A lot of people are killed at this time. And there are, what we get from the biblical text is probably around 20,000 or so are marched from Babylon up to Jerusalem. Thank you. Jerusalem up to Babylon. Yeah. And this would be those who are taken captive, royal family, nobility, bureaucrats, priests, temple personnel, all of those, the elites are taken captive, those who survive. So they're all rounded up, and you see the march here, Jerusalem. I pulled up Google Earth the other day just to try to measure this, and it's about 800 miles, 800 to 1,000 miles in that range. So they are marched from Jerusalem. Now remember, these are the elites. So a lot of these are people for whom Jerusalem was working pretty well for them. They had some level of security. And they had some level of security, so their whole world with this conquest just totally collapsed, just shattered. I'll point out in a little bit the way that we see that reflected in Ezekiel's writings, who was a priest at this time period, and we see the shattering of his world in very visceral ways in his writing. They're marched through all of this. It would have been a long journey, and it is likely a time of a lot of questions, grief, despair, and deeper reflection about what just happened. So they're marched along here. As they're going, remember these empires at this time, they can't be present everywhere all the time. So that's why a lot of people would try to go up into the highlands or different place, because it's more marginal land and you're more out of reach of the control of some of these empires. So especially as you get into the north, there's still a lot more local communities, village communities. You're also going to pass by probably some pastoralists, herders, more nomadic types who are following and living with their animals. It's possible at this time period still, even this far in history, that you're also maybe encountering at some points of the journey some hunter-gatherers. Not everywhere has been fully brought in to an imperial system. So they're likely encountering all kinds of different ways of life on this journey. And by the time they get up here, now they hit the Euphrates. And the Euphrates leads straight to Babylon. Once you get to the Euphrates, you're probably encountering field upon field upon field upon field of surplus agriculture, things that are being grown for a profit to go and feed Babylon, and also a lot of irrigation canals all along the Euphrates. And these took, hundreds, thousands of hours to build, to dig. And it's what made the agriculture possible. So you're passing all this. Then you're also passing a lot of laborers, likely servants or slaves, who are doing all of this work for Babylon. So you pass through all this area where you're encountering different ways of life, and now you're passing through here, all the fields, all the workers, all the surplus, and everything. And then you come and you walk upon Babylon. And Babylon at this time period was spectacular. The amount of wealth, some of the major wonders of the world at that time, the Hanging Gardens, the ziggurats, the temples that are present there. Just spectacular buildings. And so it would become pretty clear by the end of this journey what has been going on along the Euphrates, and all this conquest and all this labor and all this surplus, where all it's all ending up, and who it's serving. So that raises questions as you do that. Now, the other side of this is that these elites who are taken into Babylon are given neighborhoods to live in, to work, and we know that some of them actually served in the court and had higher ranking positions. So it's kind of a struggle. On the one hand, they were just conquered, they just lost their way of life, and they're seeing the cost of it all along the way, and they're asking different questions now. On the other hand, there is a real attraction and allure of Babylon itself, and there's real options here for the elite to do okay within the city. So this is so there's one is just the grief of grappling with the loss of the tradition. Remember, by this time period, especially for these elites, the temple was their faith. The temple was the center of everything. It was the center of Jewish identity at this time period, and it's that was destroyed. What does it mean? I mean, after Josiah's reforms and everything else, what does it even mean to be Jewish once the temple is destroyed here? So there is a lot of just fundamental questions being asked again about identity. And here, this is, I mean, you see a lot of these questions throughout the text, but here, by the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and there we wept when we remembered Zion. If we go to the next one.
By the way, that journey is roughly from like here to Memphis, Tennessee.
Like a
Trail
of Tears.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you say that louder?
So about the same length as the Trail of Tears was.
Yeah.
Another question they were asking was also, why did God let this happen to us? Or like, what was the purpose? What was God's purpose in allowing this to happen?
Right. I mentioned that Jeremiah was exiled to Egypt. So, you know, he's been prophesying, warning them that this is going to happen. And he even counsels, like, don't resist, because he knew the conquest was coming anyway. Like, and now he does send them a letter and send them counsel, speaking for Yahweh. Build houses, this is to the exiles now in Babylon. Build houses and live in them, plant gardens, eat what they produce, take wives, have sons and daughters, take wives for your sons. Give your daughters in marriage that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there, don't decrease. But seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile, and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will find your welfare. This is very early in exile. This is just a few years into it. So, you know, we see different responses and reactions to this as the exile goes on. Early on, Jeremiah is like, he knows the grief and the despair and the pain, and it's like, don't just look back, but do your best and create a new life here, because he knows they're going to be there for a while. So that's one thing that they're wrestling with. And we have a lot of accounts. I mean, we do know that they did that, and that there was a Jewish community there, and that they came together, they worked, and like I said, a lot of them got jobs, and even some jobs in the court at different levels within society. But the other thing that's going on in Babylon is they have their own stories. So the people are leaving Jerusalem, where we've talked about the tradition that's emerging, and the stories, and we've got the patriarchs and the matriarchs, and we've got, you know, Exodus Sinai account, and we've got all these traditions and these stories that are emerging. Well, now they get to Babylon, which means Babylon means gate of the gods, and basically what that means is that God's presence is inside the city walls. The divine is found inside the city walls. Everything outside of the city walls is like chaos, disorder. God's spirit is not present there. It's only when you're inside the city that you're actually in the presence of God. With that, in there, I'm especially thinking here about Enuma Elish, which is one of their primary, it's their origin story, Babylonian creation myth. In this, all these different stories, well, this story in particular shows that it argues for redemptive violence. things come into being through violence, you could say through warfare, but it's ultimately for the purpose of peace or for redemption. Here, we have, help me, Isaac, is this Marduk and Tiamat?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Tiamat is the fresh water god being killed by her son, Marduk, who then rises. So it's actually a story about fresh water being killed by one of the children. This is the origin story. It was very, very violent. Other things that come out in some of these narratives is that the king is the chief god, the embodiment of God. Hierarchy is equated with the divine order. And then the big one is that human beings, aside from some of the elites and the kings and everything, are basically made to work for the kings. Human beings are just made to be servants or slaves. So that's right in the heart of this account. So the Judeans, the Jewish people, are there, and they're having to wrestle with, well, who are we now? And you see some of the questions that I have being asked. Why are we here? What went wrong? Will we ever go back? Are we Babylonians now? Is this our story? Are these the stories that we're going to pass on to our children? Was the temple, was the king, Solomon, on? Was this entire civilizational project that we're starting to reflect on our march, was this all a big mistake to begin with? So, for sure, some people just went the route of Babylon. And they kind of entered in, they worked their jobs, and they got along. Others asked, and including some of the priests and the scribes, asked deeper fundamental questions. And more recently, people are realizing that this is probably the time period when the early books of Genesis came together, was in the asking of these questions, Genesis 1 to 11. Genesis 1 to 11 is the creation account. Well, a couple of creation accounts. Genesis 1, and then we have 2 to 3, Adam and Eve, and what we know as the fall, going all the way to the Tower of Babel, and it ends there. So I just want to touch on these really quickly, a few of the lessons that are coming out here, because it helps us understand what the people at this time are wrestling with, and they're drawing from stories that were probably present again in the oral tradition, but these really kind of take shape and solidify and are deepened at this time period. So, first of all, and I wish I could spend more time on these.
So, was the Genesis story created orally before this and written down at this point? Is that what you're saying? Or
yeah.
Was it invented at this point, or created at this point?
It's some of it would be drawn from some oral history, but a lot of it, this shape, and a lot of these stories would have really come together at this time.
In oral culture, among oral traditions, mm-hmm. times of great crisis solidify the oral stories much and give it depth and give it flesh, if you will. So like, well, to put a modern example on it, the Oshetkishakawin have an oral story of prophecy about the black snake prophecy. So now there's this crisis with this pipeline happening, and it gives this oral story much, much more depth.
Mm.
And it becomes more widely circulated.
Yeah.
So I would say probably what's happening here is there are these stories and traditions, but because there is this crisis, this existential crisis on the ground right now, they're reaching back into their tradition as a way of identifying who they are and looking for direction. And it gives depth to the story, it gives character to the story, and it goes very widely circulated.
Thank you.
I just want to add to that something that you taught me another time about the oral tradition, was that also depending on the time that you're in, the way you would tell a story, what you emphasize, what part of the story you emphasize, depends on what circumstances you're telling the story in.
Mm-hmm. Good, thank you.
Good question.
Yeah.
So I think so. Jeremiah was a prophet for the elites then, in a way?
Jeremiah, he's a prophet to the elites.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, he's really prophesying about, like, grieving about what Jerusalem has become in the temple. and weeping about that. Like, we have to accept what's coming here and do our best not to piece things back together as he starts to counsel later on.
And were they mm-hmm. were they at least oppressive in Jerusalem, or okay?
So I think what you're seeing is, I mean, they've been really humbled by their defeat and their exile. And so they've got a lot of time for self-reflection, and some of them take that seriously and have a change of heart, and now are, you know, kind of repenting of some of these old ways. Some of them, like John said, continue to go along and don't have that change of heart and just kind of immerse themselves in Babylonian life. But some of them, like, really are humbled and take this reflection seriously.
And, like, this journey, like, 800-mile journey, was that, like, a couple of months or a year, or...?
It doesn't say. I'm going to go through these pretty quick, so I won't... they raise a lot of questions. I won't be able to do them justice, but I just want you to get a feel for their overall sweep of Genesis 1 to 11 and, you know, the questions that are being asked and what they're coming to. So in Genesis 1, I mentioned that they have their own... Babylon has the Enuma Elish, its own origin story. We start Genesis 1 with "in the beginning." It's a counter-narrative that's being put out. It's a different origin story that's being put forward in this time. And up until this point, the God of Israel is Yahweh, and very much just a God of Israel. I mean, like, it is their God. Here we start to see God portrayed much more as creator and the God of all creation. Because they're in a different context, and they have to think about this now in relationship to the Babylonian gods. So... it shifts. There's a lot of different themes that come out in this first chapter. One is, God is present in all creation, which is a huge difference from God being confined inside the city walls, right? And not being present outside. Also, there's a sense of, there's a phrase that gets translated a lot as void, but it can also be like a wilderness, tohu wabohu. Yeah. And, one of my favorite Hebrew words, tohu wabohu. But it's a sense of God bringing life and fertility and to a wilderness context. So in the Babylonian myth, Enuma Elish, the wilderness is just barren, it's void, it's chaos, right? It's like you don't want to go out there, you just want to be in the center. Here it presents a kind of sense of life coming, fertility within that wilderness context. There is also a real emphasis. I mean, it goes through the creation account. Even humans being made in the image of God is a huge contrast to what's present in Babylon at this time, where the humans are just being created as, they're present to work as servants or as slaves. So we do have texts here that have been really problematic, like humans being given dominion and all of this, and that's been weaponized in really awful ways throughout the course of Christendom on. Colonialism. In this context, it's like it is a counter to so much of this of the earth has already been raised. I mean, it's just in bad shape, and now humans being entrusted to bring that to life in different ways too. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the senses that you get in this early text. There's a lot there. I'm just going to touch on those few things quick. Oh, the last thing is Sabbath, and Sabbath is introduced. God rests, and if God rests, then for sure the community is going to be called to enact Sabbath. And Sabbath, in a context of empire where everything is about production, produce, and your job is to work the irrigation canals or whatever and do this for the surplus to come into the kings. To introduce Sabbath right into the heart of created order is a radical shift. All right, Genesis. Sugi?
What's the scene? I don't know, like the negative or positive, what the rest means in the midst of a production, like productive society. Is it then regarded as a negative or a positive?
I think the text, I think they're presenting it as a positive, as a value, lifting it up. Within the society, it would be seen as laziness or whatever.
By the elites as a negative.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because they can't force the people to work all the time.
Yeah. And we saw that in the the community. This is something that goes right to the early founding of the people up in the highlands. Jubilee, which we'll talk about more later, Jubilee was introduced. It's like types of regular Sabbath for the land and for the people. Right? So Sabbath is really critical here, this rest, and it's introduced then right into the early creation account, portraying God as resting on the seventh day. Going ahead to Genesis 2-3. I touched on this last week. Jim Baer and others have preached on this in different ways too. We're used to the fall being presented as a fall into sin. It actually doesn't talk about sin in the text here. It's not present here. What we do have, and again, I'm reflecting on this journey and this walk, and what kind of questions the people would have been asking as they walked all along and trying to figure out, how did we get to this point? And so I'll just pull up. You know, the whole thing in 3 is all about God just setting limits. Like, there are limits to living. You can't just take everything, right? And so there's a sense of that. And they're in the garden, and the garden is very much take what is given, but they want to reach beyond the limits and take something that is off limits, right? So we get basically the consequences, the outworking of once humanity overreaches, goes beyond what is just provided, goes beyond limits that the Creator has set. And I read some of these last week, but increase your pangs in childbearing to the woman, and pain you shall bring forth children. There's lots of different things here, but one thing is that a shift from hunter-gatherer societies to surplus agriculture societies is a huge increase in children for a number of different reasons. But that is population explosion happens right away. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. The rise of patriarchy that happens with this move in settled agriculture, patriarchy emerges in this context. Cursed shall be the ground because of you. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. It's thorns and thistles, and I mentioned that those are weeds, pioneer species, that this is something that happens when you till and dig the soil. Eat the plants of the field. You shall eat bread. That comes from wheat, annual grasses that they've shifted to, and then the end of it. So this is outlining the consequences of this fall. It is a fall into, you could say, into surplus agriculture, monocrop agriculture. It's a fall into cities. It's eventually a fall into civilization and empires that they're experiencing in Babylon that we see narrated in this text. Now in chapter 4, it gets really interesting. Because chapter 4, we have Cain and Abel. And Tom mentioned this last week. So, Abel is a pastoralist. Cain is a tiller of the field. Cain is an agriculturalist. At this, throughout the rest of Genesis, we do not have agriculturalists present in the text. We have pastoralists mostly. We have some mercenaries. I mean, we have like different, but we don't have agriculturalists. What we have here is, and this is where sin enters. Okay, so the voice comes down, sin is lurking at your door to Cain. Master it before it basically takes you over. Cain, we know, kills Abel, gets jealous, gets upset. This is something that was happening leading up to this time period all the time. Agriculturalists killing pastoralists. Because agriculturalists are looking to expand. And nobody just freely converts into this lifestyle because it's hard work. So this pattern, this is a kind of a larger story about a pattern that is happening again and again up until now. Okay. Cain kills, the blood is mixed with the soil. And then we have Cain, who becomes a wanderer, is cast out. Jimbear?
It's important to point out that they would have been feeding the same land too.
Yeah.
It's the age old. Free grazing versus ranch kind of stuff. They would have been competing with the same land.
Yeah, thank you. And then what happens with Cain and his punishment? He becomes a wanderer, which is part of agriculture, which is like always looking and wandering, and it kind of uproots people and looking for more and for more eventually. So now we see that his children, amongst his children, he has Enoch, who is the first to build a city in his name. So the descendant of Cain is the first to build a city, the first to forge metal tools, and the first to respond to violence with escalating violence. Kind of begins this cycle, the spiral of violence. So we see all the effects happening here. connected to Cain. Then we move on to the flood narrative, and we see that violence is now just widespread everywhere. The cycle of violence has just been unleashed with this shift. And Noah, and we know the story of the ark, all living things, you know, all of creation, flora and fauna, we have coming, animals, plants, all being brought onto the ark to preserve it. Interesting part of this is that there's a lot of flood narratives floating around at this time period, so they kind of put their own spin on it. And
what's that?
Floating around. Floating around, yeah. Unintentional pun. Yeah. And this is a connection that, you know, 6,000 BCE, the waters rose around Earth, and especially in that area. That is connected to a large glacial lake in northern Minnesota and Canada at that time period. Lake Agassiz, I think is how you pronounce it. It was bigger than all the Great Lakes combined. And a part of that broke open up to the north, and it just immediately, you had the rising of the oceans all around the world in this area. And we can see what was just wiped out in the coastal plains. They've done a lot of work on this around 6,000 BC, and right around that time period, we get a lot of these flood narratives that start to occur. So there's these flood narratives. This is their take. They're working of one of these flood narratives, responding to all of this and attempting to preserve a remnant of all living things of creation. There's nothing, no mention of any like technology, tools, all the things that have been manufactured by human hands. It's like, it's, let's save everything else here. And then we get 10 and 11. And this is, you know, it didn't work. We kind of fall right back into it. And now we're up to Tower of Babel. Babel is, at that time period, a pejorative name for Babylon. It has to do with the gates, and it kind of combines the gate of the gods with the scattering, and the meaning in one word, but it's a pejorative word for Babylon. It talks about the plain of Shinar. That is the Fertile Crescent that it's referencing there. And you see there movement to settlement, and people settling, and they are building a city, and with the city comes a tower. We've talked about this ziggurats. The temples that are set up right away in the city. And the reason is for centralization of worship, of ideology, to bring the people together, right? And this is the name. All the people coming together. Let's see if I can find it here real quick. Oh, the text actually says brick bricks. It's kind of like these kids playing. It says it all kind of playfully. These kids, they just think they're bricking bricks. And God comes down from the heavens and looks down on them, and they think they've built this massive tower, and Yahweh looks down on them. And they're trying to make a name for themselves, and they're trying to centralize all around this one name. And what does God do in this account? And that's scatter them. He scatters their attempts to build a tower and to build a city and to build an empire with this pejorative name for Babylon. So all of this, from the beginning of the creation account up through Genesis 11, is a commentary on what I started out with last week. The rise of surplus agriculture leading to the rise of cities and kings and temples and all of that. So that's something that is being wrestled with in Babylon out of the questions that emerge with what happened. And Jim Bear is talking about maybe some of the crystallizing, coming together of the oral traditions this time period.
So is the Tower of Babel story like prophesying the fall of Babylon, or is it just more saying this whole way of life is destined for destruction?
A little bit of both, but I would interpret it as the latter.
I think it's more commentary.
Yeah,
I always took it as mockery.
Yeah.
It's just like, you think you're so great, ha ha ha.
Yeah.
You know, then you make fun, and then you bring humor, and then what can the people in power do with humor? Right? It's always
that's
people
good.
Who are underneath who can actually make fun of somebody.
And that's the
right?
Coming down, the bricking bricks. The,
yeah,
they're just children
funny.
Thinking that they're building something great.
Yeah. That's how I was really, yeah.
I think the closest parallel we might have is how like The Daily Show does news.
Yeah.
Or The Colbert Report, when that was popular. They do real news, but totally through the lens of parody and mockery. And that's the, you know, comedy is the power of the powerless.
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, picture Donald Trump trying to be funny. Just trying, you know. Okay.
Susie?
When I was in Bible college, the professor talked about this narrative, and he talked about, so God's up in heaven, and he hears this faint little noise, so he turns to see what they're doing, and he comes on down, and then he sees their tower. And it was sort of like the humor of the bigness of God compared to the littleness of what they were doing. Mm. And so he said that that's how, what the Hebrew alluded to, like God heard this little noise and thought he'd go check it out.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of cool. The other thing is that we did quite a bit on the Babylonian narrative of the Epic of Gilgamesh, as opposed to the Bible.
The flood narrative, right?
Comparing the two flood narratives, and there was enough that, the Bible kind of ripped off the Epic of Gilgamesh. I mean, we basically just copied it and just put our spin on it, except, Noah didn't get beer in our narrative. He got beer in the Babylonian one, so.
Well, it's taking a story that's popular and then saying, these are the theological changes we're placing on it. This is our imprint on it. This is how we are claiming it.
And so the changes are really key.
So the changes are like everyone would have known the story, and then you hear the changes of the way that you're telling it, and then it especially creates identity, right?
But for our professor,
it's ironic.
For the professor at a Pentecostal school to tell a bunch of kids that their story didn't come first. It was like blasphemous.
I mean, so it's important to understand that Genesis 1 through 11 uses very ancient storytelling forms in there. You have creation narrative, flood narrative. There's all of these forms in there, and they're putting spins on it. And one of the things that the Tower of Babel narrative does is it allows Israel to differentiate themselves from Babylonians. Mm. Because if you have this overarching meta-narrative that all of humanity descends from one couple, and now these people, who by your own narrative, you're related to, are treating you in this fashion, you need to come up with a narrative to differentiate yourselves from them. And this allows that to happen. And it answers a lot of questions, right? Yeah. If we all come from the same descendant, why don't we understand each other's languages? Why are people scattered? And this narrative, it's an explanatory narrative. It takes these questions and answers them, while at the same time being a political commentary.
Thank you. Both. The one thing you just reminded me that I forgot to mention is even it, like Adam and Eve, Adam, Adama, is human and hummus. It is humanity and soil. I mean, it's like intricately connected. One comes from the other. And then you have the same sort of connection with Ish and Isha, man and the woman. And so there is in the wordplay, there is a deep sense of connection between human and soil, and then also between the male and the female, the interrelatedness, which would also be in the context as a way of drawing a distinction where you're just separated from all those things in different ways in a Babylonian context. I want to move us on because this is important, and I'm glad we spent time on this, but I'll move quickly over the next couple sections. Ezekiel, again, in Ezekiel, Isaiah, and in Genesis 1 to 11, a similar conception of God is more of a creator rather than just a local God, Yahweh, that we see early on. So there's a shift to that. I mentioned Ezekiel, the first part of Ezekiel. Ezekiel was a priest and prophet in Jerusalem. Ezekiel is one of the elites. Ezekiel's entire world collapses. And we get a sense, a feel of that in the first half of the text. I mean, it's like, you can just feel his world coming undone, and then slowly, like the grief and the despair and the lament and the rage, and then slowly coming back together in the second half of the text. It's really incredible. And he gives then hope for a renewed Israel. And this is one of the famous passages. A new heart I will give you, a new spirit I will put within you. And I will remove from your body the heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh. And, you know, you shall live in the land again. And there starts to be, later on, some hope and some longing to go back and to return, but with a new spirit. In other words, it's like getting the hardness, everything that the temple had caused and created for the people, and the centralization, the empire, and all that, being purged out of them, so they can go back and relate anew. And this is the next chapter. You have the dry bones coming to life again. Really vivid, vivid imagery. Now in Isaiah, again, this is 2nd Isaiah, so I won't spend long on this. There's 1st Isaiah, pre-exile. These prophets would often have schools of disciples around them that they would be teaching. And then they would go on and they would write out of that same school and they would write in the name of their master.
Which chapters?
Isaiah 40 to 55.
You said 1st Isaiah.
Oh, 1st Isaiah is 1 to 44. Or 1 to 39. 2nd Isaiah 40 to 55. So 2nd Isaiah, so 1st Isaiah is written pre-exile. 2nd Isaiah, 40 to 55, is written during their time in Babylon. And the whole thing, 2nd Isaiah, the author, would have been second generation, would have been born in Babylon, did not experience the exile. So you get a very different tone, very pastoral, very comforting, is not interested in judging the people for what had caused their exile. They've suffered. Now he just wants to give them a pastoral, comforting word. And you know, he talks about, again, doing a new thing, making a way in the wilderness and rivers in the desert, and a lot of ecological imagery, imagery of creation, springing back to life in 2nd Isaiah. Talks about a new exodus, the people returning again to the land. The other thing that we find, and we don't have this here, but there's these servant songs that get used a lot, and we understand Jesus in light of these songs. The last one is the suffering servant. We read this. I think Dana puts together this amazing PowerPoint every Good Friday, the suffering servant, and some of the artwork that goes along with it. You know, crushed for our afflictions, or afflicted for our transgressions, and beautiful passage. But it's likely that 2nd Isaiah, the author himself, because he was anti-Babylonian, he was pro-returning to Jerusalem, he also saw Persia coming in, King Cyrus, as their best hopes for that, that he was likely persecuted and imprisoned for this, because there would have been Babylonian sympathizers present in the exiled community as well. So in 2nd Isaiah, we get a sense of some of the divides and the splits within the community. People who were pro-Babylonian by this time, because they had good jobs and positions and they had kind of settled in. And then others who were like, no, like, this is not our home and we have to go back. And even welcoming King Cyrus, that we'll talk about in a second. So this this reading, if we read it through, he had no former majesty that we should look at him, nothing in appearance we should desire, despised and rejected by others, a man of suffering, and it goes on to talk about how the suffering is for the people. This then makes sense more as we start to interpret and understand Jesus in light of this too, as somebody who enters in to the same tradition as 2nd Isaiah in suffering with and for the people and their place of colonial domination. So we'll get to that. Okay, so that's Babylon. Questions. Who are we after our encounter with Babylon? Where is the community at now from 587 up to 539 at the end of their exile and when they can start returning? So they're going to settle on this in different ways. For some, do we assimilate? Yes. Many of the exiles would be accommodationists who believe that their relative prosperity, relatively prosperous position in Babylon, is a sign of Yahweh's favor. So there are those who are okay now with the second generation and those who have good positions. This would be related more to what we'd be calling some of the big tradition. Others would say no. Other exiles become highly critical of the old temple. Genesis 1 to 11. I mean, the very process that gave rise to all this to begin with, even of civilization and empire in any form. So we see the whole spectrum of positions in terms of who we are present at this time and place within the Babylonian exile.
55?
Yeah. I'm going to stop there for a second. Do we want to go to the next, or do we just want to take a break right now?
Well, we're a little behind, but it's okay. 8:40. So.
Okay. 5 minute break?
Yeah. Okay. Take a 5 minute break. We're going to try and make it really 5 minutes because we're a little bit behind, but you know, stretch, do the bathroom. I'll get the cookies.
All right, quick break. We're going to hit some key points now in these next few sections and move a little quicker. Wanted to spend a little time with Genesis. But one question over the break, well, asked twice, so it's probably important to talk about. Big tradition, little tradition, just in the way that we're using that. Last week we talked about Solomon and his construction of the temple and the palace and then Josiah's reforms and further, like shutting down local sites of worship, further centralizing everything around the temple. And the whole narrative then gets located around the temple, and everybody else who was able to, was living more in village communities, practicing local sites of worship, all of that got, and who were typically poor and just struggling to survive. The big tradition is that which gets located around the temple in the city. It is that which benefits 3, 4, 5% of the population who are connected with the temple professionally. So they have their own narrative, and their narrative is pretty dominant because they write. They're producing a lot of the texts. What is amazing is that the little tradition is still is retained and gets into the texts. And those are some of the voices we lift up. The prophets carry that forward because they keep reminding people. Little tradition is Jubilee and Sabbath and life in a village where we share together and where we host each other and we take care of each other and where we recognize Yahweh connected to us and to the land around that we're caring for.
Can I add something? I would say like this also, that the big tradition is basically the view of the elites of the Jewish society, and the little tradition is the view of the common people. And then the prophets are very interesting.
Yeah.
A lot of the prophets come from the elites. And that's why they speak to their fellow elites. But they represent the little guy. So Jeremiah would be an example, and Ezekiel especially, who are part of the elites, but represent the voice of the common people. And then you have someone like Amos, who comes from the common class.
The shepherd of the court.
Right, so he's a commoner who also speaks on behalf of the common people and somehow gets a hearing among the elites, the kings and all that stuff. So the prophets, their backgrounds could be different, but they're basically representing the common people of the little tradition, unless they're court prophets hired, you know, and directed in the payroll of the kings.
But I get that the last section's confusing because we just talked about all the elites being exiled, all part connected to the big tradition. And so we're trying to like kind of keep this framework going. So here, the little tradition would just be those elites who, like Ezekiel, were so completely undone by the exile and questioned everything and had a new understanding of what it means to be the people of God that was much closer to the Sinai tradition, Jubilee, Covenant, all of that. Okay, well, we'll keep talking about that because we bring that into every section. And what is the tension and the argument present in each time period? 539 BCE, so we have Babylon to the north, Persia to the east rises in power, King Cyrus, and a lot of those who are exiled in Jerusalem are really happy about this development because Persia has a different way of relating to its subjects. So here's the extent of the Persian Empire. We'll see that whereas Babylon just like conquers, brings the elites and scatters or kills the rest, Persia is, they'll encourage local rule. And they'll encourage local rule through the traditions of the people. And so long as those who are leading that local rule, the priests, the governor, so long as they are ultimately loyal to Persia and fulfill their aims. So it's a strategic thing, because if they can keep the people happy, but if they have the leaders loyal to them, then they fulfill all of their objectives. So King Cyrus at this time, this is why Isaiah, others, see, they even portray King Cyrus as a sort of Messiah. Not a follower of Yahweh, but liberating the people. The main tension that emerges during this time period, during life under Persian rule, is the tension between the returning exiles and the people who were never exiled in the first place, but who also were not killed. And that would be the poorer folks, those in the surrounding villages, in Ezra, they are called the people of the land. So, if you think about the experience of the people of the land with the exile, for the elites, it's terrible. And for the people of the land, it's probably traumatic as well. I mean, these are the common people that Pastor Dim was pointing out. But all of a sudden, they were probably, a lot of them were dispossessed, displaced from their ancestral landholdings, and they were experiencing heavy taxation, and they were just barely surviving. And now some of this land opens up, and they start to return to and resettle some of their ancestral landholdings. And they've got a period of time there where they can start to recreate some of the kinship ties, some of the village life and community that had been broken up by Solomon's temple, by Josiah's reforms, all of that. So there was some good in Babylonian conquest that was present there for the people of the land. And now Cyrus is sending all of the elites back to resettle and rebuild Jerusalem. So this is, when we're talking about big tradition, little tradition, if you look at the end of this section, now you have the Jewish rulers handpicked by Persia, lifting up Cyrus to come back and resettle, and you have the people of the land who are a lot more hesitant about this temple being rebuilt. And they're not as interested in temple formality, but they're interested in justice being proclaimed for Yahweh's sake, as we'll see. For the people of the land, true worship and imperial rule are not compatible. For those returning elites handpicked by Cyrus to go back and resettle, the temple is a good thing, because they're going to get key positions there. So we see some of this disputes in the text. You can read about the people of the land here a little bit more. Ezra and Nehemiah is really interesting. Ezra and Nehemiah is basically saying King Cyrus has received a word from Yahweh and issues an edict. It's been called by Yahweh to send back people, and it happens in different waves, to go back and to resettle. And this is commissioned by Yahweh. I have heard in the past week people using the text of Nehemiah to argue for and justify Christians for the Muslim ban that Donald Trump, and for the building of the wall and all of that. Some of that in the Christian tradition comes from Ezra and Nehemiah. Because what you find in Ezra and Nehemiah is a strong emphasis on purity, now on ethnic purity. And they are told, here we go. The people of Israel, the priests and the Levites, have not separated themselves from the peoples of the land with their abominations. They have taken some of their daughters as wives for themselves and for their sons. Thus the holy seed has mixed itself with the peoples of the lands, and in this faithlessness, the officials and leaders have led the way. And then Ezra, when he hears this, he tears his garment, and he's so despairing. A lot of this text is don't intermix. Forbids mixing in marriage. Whole emphasis is on maintaining now ethnic purity, and ethnic purity is the returning elites, the people of the land. And this goes back to some of what was happening with the people of the north earlier, and Assyria, sending some of their subjects in to marry and to mix. And so it's now it all becomes about ethnic purity at this point. And ethnic purity gets connected to the temple.
I'm curious about the mixing and shifting of languages as well. Is there much information known about how the languages influenced each other through these evolutions of empires?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know much about that.
Well, I'm guessing that it's the people of the land, they're not literate, so we would never know.
It's also worth pointing out that the people of the land are fellow Israelites,
right?
But they have mixed with other people, and by that standard, we have a lot of sinners right here who would be condemned by Ezra too. And it's interesting that the people are some of the people who are pointing to Trump as Cyrus are doing that in a positive way, and There's
and
a lot of truth to
Nehemiah.
That.
Yeah.
Right, but notice that Trump's rise was predicated on racism or white supremacy and xenophobia, and trying to keep our borders secure so that white people don't mix with other people, basically, right? It's very much this kind of ethnic purity and cleansing that's very reminiscent of fascism in the 1930s. We're not saying that we're there mm-hmm. yet, but the impulse is very similar, and it, that impulse we see also in biblical times.
Yeah. Yes.
Huh? Question, so why ethnic purity and stuff? What is the cause for them to actually, is it Cyrus is like telling them to go, but then he's also saying to be ethnically pure too? Or what's the end
yeah.
game for this, I guess?
Well, remember, the people of the land have resettled some of these areas. I mean, they want some of that land in those areas, and they have very different values at this point than the elites who are returning. So they're not going to be as loyal subjects and loyal to Persia as the elites who are returning. And I'm going to get some of these positions. So.
Let me take a crack at that, too.
Okay.
The people that are already there are running things, right?
Mm.
Then you have the elites that were coming from Babylon that were just newly liberated by Persia.
Mm.
I'm not sure if Persia cares all that much about their ethnic makeup,
mm-hmm.
but Persia has authorized these people from Babylon, these elites. It's the elites that were extracted from Palestine to go to Babylon in the first place. Now those elites and their descendants are coming back. So when the elites say, hey, all this ethnic mixing is wrong and sinful. And so for religious reasons, we have not just imperial authority,
mm-hmm.
but we have religious authority
mm-hmm.
from God to rule over you and take back your land and tell you what to do and have you be our servants.
Mm-hmm.
So they're basically shoring up their authority, both from their Persian masters and now through religious purity angle.
Mm-hmm. So in a way, they had to like abstract a holy something
mm-hmm.
to make do an unnatural.
They have to be holier
something.
Than thou.
Yeah.
Yeah, to do like an unnatural act, which is unnatural to them too. So they had to like make this up in a way to.
Yeah, and now this very much again follows some of the pattern that we saw with Josiah / Joshua,
mm-hmm.
what we were talking about there too. And it also mirrors Babylon to a degree because now Jerusalem becomes the holy city, and what is inside is pure and holy. And that which is outside is
mixed up.
Yeah, it's profane. It's impure. It's mixed up. So that which is in now the city walls. The city walls are rebuilt. Is holy. Same structure as was present in Babylon
mm-hmm.
and a lot of these cities at that time period.
John, are they not also calling the people of the land foreigners?
Yes.
Yeah. So they're using the term foreigners for people who were there. The people of the land.
Yeah.
They use
yeah.
the term foreigners. Which would also make sense why that those verses and that language is being co-opted right now by the right.
Yeah.
On this Muslim ban.
And think about our view of Native Americans. You know, white people are indigenous in our national imagination, and Native people are foreigners, really.
That's because they can't tell the difference between a Native person and a Mexican person or anything.
It's worth pointing out kind of in the overarching narrative, like so many of the prophets before the exile talk about how the elite are taking advantage of the poor so
mm.
strongly. So we have then that those two groups again returning. I don't think the people of the land were all that thrilled about them returning, and
mm-hmm.
probably after a little while, they were probably kind of happy that the elite were taken in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't have a very
Absolutely.
Good, they didn't have a very good relationship. So,
yes.
like, I think that this would not have been a happy reunion. It's not like they really missed those cousins very much. You know, they
yeah.
were the poor. What's the verse about turning your poor into sandals or something like that? Right? I mean,
yeah,
that
yeah.
right?
Yeah, it's for them the elites. Being exiled is kind of a jubilee.
Who's
yeah.
So
there's a serious class conflict that we have often glossed over in our Christian education for most of us.
Yeah.
Even if told
yeah. And just one point here real quick. The other thing that we see, like Ezra 4:4-7, is that the people of the land, many of them do oppose the rebuilding of the temple, and they send letters to the kings. And like one king after another, saying, if you do this, like, we're going to oppose it and we're going to make it difficult for you.
Mm.
And it works for a time. They actually delay the rebuilding of the temple because of these letters that are sent, which only then increases the hatred towards the people of the land for the people returning and who want to rebuild the temple. All right, so there's a lot of conflict going on here in the text at this time. Is there another?
Oh, yeah. So is this 40 years, like, so they were exiled, and so it's like about, so like almost, it's only like half a lifetime almost, right? So it's, people still remember, is that right? So was it like a longer than that?
Yeah, 587 to 539.
Okay.
Yeah, was the length of the exile, but the resettlement,
mm-hmm.
Actually, like the text presents it happening kind of quickly. It actually takes a good 100 years, and it's a very gradual thing. So it's not until 445 that it's fully, from 539 to 445, that the temple is fully rebuilt. So, yeah, this resettlement happens slowly. I want to talk on the back here, point D, about Persia's motivation for this. Why is Persia sending back sending back some of these Jewish elites? And they're actually giving them positions of high priest and governor. They get both positions. Ultimately, it falls to Ezra and Nehemiah, the ones that do all this, Ezra being the priest and Nehemiah being the governor. So, point D, why would Persia allow the rebuilding of Jerusalem? The temple and the wall. Persia needed... I want to make sure I have a different one I'm looking at here. Okay, I got it now. Persia needed a strong military base in Jerusalem to keep any revolts from Egypt at bay. The temple was rebuilt as the symbol of Jewish identity, and the rebuilt wall around Jerusalem made the whole city a garrison of Persia. This ingenious strategy meant that when the Jews defended their temple and city, they were also defending the Persian Empire. So Greece had been rising up in the north. There's a Delian League that came together, all to withstand, even go against Persia, which emboldened Egypt to the south. Egypt is rising, and they're just difficult subjects for Persia at this time. So they need kind of a wall of defense. They don't want Egypt to encroach and to take over this area. So they send back the Jewish people to resettle, build a temple, build a wall, and then they make it in their interest to do so, so that they're going to fight to defend it, which makes Persia's job easy. Because when they're fighting to defend it, then they're also holding off Egypt.
And may we add, how many of us have seen the movie 300? Right, this is a similar time. So imagine, I mean, Persia's greatest foe at this time is Greece, and they need every soldier possible to conquer Greece. So if the Jews can do the work of keeping Egypt kind of in line, then they don't have to split up all their forces. So this is all happening at the same time. But those of us who study... This is a problem. When we study like regular history, we're studying the Persian War with Greece.
Yeah.
And then when we're studying biblical history,
yeah,
we're in this part, and we're not like connecting that this is actually one empire,
yeah,
you know, happening in multiple places.
One of the prophets who's writing there during this time period now is 3rd Isaiah. So 1st Isaiah pre-exile, 2nd Isaiah during the exile. 3rd Isaiah is writing after the exile, and we...
The period of the Clone Wars. Multiple Isaiahs.
Yeah. We see 3rd Isaiah responding to this directly. Here is one of the texts. This is one of the passages that we took on for our church, the identity of Church of All Nations, a house of prayer for all peoples. But if you read this, "And the foreigners who join themselves to the Lord to minister to him, to love the name of the Lord and to be his servants, all who keep the Sabbath and do not profane it and hold fast to my covenant, these I will bring to my holy mountain." This includes the foreigners or the people of the land who were there. "And make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices will be accepted at my altar, for my house shall be called a house of prayer for all peoples. Thus says the Lord God, who gathers the outcasts of Israel, I will gather others to them besides those already gathered." In this context, this is a direct response to these moves that are happening with these returning elites and this emphasis upon purity in the holy city and exclusion of the people of the land or of foreigners. Another passage, I mean, there's so many examples in 3rd Isaiah. 3rd Isaiah is 55 to 66, chapters 55 to 66. Another one is this the kind of fast that I have chosen? And calling them to loose the chains of injustice. Dealing with some of the economic disparities that are emerging at this time. And then the last one that I'm just going to read for you, because it's familiar to us from the Gospels. 61 1-4. It's longer than that, but let's read this. The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me. He has sent me to bring good news to the oppressed, to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives and release to the prisoners. Proclaim the year...
Thank you.
Such a good part of the text. To proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, Jubilee, and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn, to provide for those who mourn in Zion, to give them a garland instead of ashes. And it just goes on. They shall build up the ancient ruins, raise up the former devastation, repair the ruined cities, the devastations of many generations. But the whole text is going back to and reclaiming the Jubilee tradition in what it's talking about. This is the text that in Luke 4, Jesus then stands up and proclaims to the people, right? And he gets, they know exactly what he's doing. When Jesus reads this text, he again is landing on this tradition and he is criticizing what's happening with the temple in Jerusalem. All the people who are watching him, the Sadducees and the scribes and everybody who's following and watching his every move, they know exactly what he's claiming and what he's signaling when he reads this text. And in Luke, he makes that his mission statement for his ministry. And everything else that he does in the rest of Luke is about economic justice and redistribution, liberating resources for the people.
It's especially obvious because goes outside of the lectionary passages.
Oh.
Like basically, there's like a Jewish lectionary, basically.
Yeah.
And he like discards it on that day. When he goes out.
That's good, thank you.
Awesome. Most of
stuff. Okay. I'm going to leave it at that for this section and move on to. Oh, this is good.
And we've got the summary questions.
Okay. So, a point here that I want to emphasize again, the temple, right now, so we're in the rebuilt temple period. This is the second temple. The first temple is Solomon's temple. Now the temple has been rebuilt. There is a difference between these two. Both were not good for the people. But in the first temple, it was still an independent Judea, an independent people. This second temple is now colonial. And from here on, this is the role that the temple plays, the whole Second Temple period. From Persia, and we're going to talk about Greece, and then we're going to talk about Rome. Just a brief interlude with the Hasmoneans, but even that is pretty colonial. So this is a colonized Judea and a colonial temple. And so that's the difference between the two. But the point here is that the temple was always bad for the common people. Which elites benefit from the temple system changes at this time? During the First Temple, the beneficiaries were Judean elites. From here on, the ultimate beneficiaries will be a foreign colonial power, first Persia, then Greece, then Rome. Mm-hmm. The high priest collects the tithes, collects the offerings, surplus, taxation, everybody has to come in. It's an economic center as well for the city. And they get to keep some of that, and the rest of it gets sent off to Persia. Or it gets sent off to Greece, or it gets sent off to Rome. That's the way the temple functions. It is also the center... It's originally a central storehouse, it's the bank, it's the center of commerce as well.
But primarily, it's the place where all the tribute is collected to be sent to foreign empires,
yes.
With the priestly class skimming a little bit,
yes.
For their services.
Yeah. Yeah. And we just need to start thinking about this and really absorb this, because this is the primary dispute and the... when we see Jesus saying woe unto you or F you, basically, it's always concerning the temple leadership.
That's right.
Okay? This is who Jesus is coming up against, and this is who reacts to him and is trying to eventually get him and crucify him. Same structure. Temple and Rome. And here it's temple and Persia.
Mm-hmm. Just a question. Was this built like a fort then? Like before it was more like a temple for worshiping and stuff, I'm guessing? But this time, since the colonial power was built more like a fort, like a defense fortress in a way, or am I thinking of that wrong?
There was, in a later empire, kind of a citadel built right next to the temple.
Mm-hmm.
But not quite that militaristic.
Because the whole city had a wall around it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jerusalem had a very
okay.
strong wall.
And this is the center.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Jerusalem was like a fort, but the temple was kind of in the middle.
And in fact, Persia built, John pointed earlier was that Persia had sent the elites back to order the rebuilding of the temple and the wall around Jerusalem, so that the whole city was a garrison of the Persian Empire, especially as a military checkpoint for Egypt.
This is really the biggest point we need to get tonight. All the other historical details are not as important. If we can understand what the temple signifies, what its role and place is at this time, the second temple period, beginning now, going all the way to Jesus' time, then it's going to open up a lot for us. So this is really key. The rest of it is just like kind of talking about different little changes, ways it changes a little bit in different historical periods.
Can I just add one? For our contemporary time, temples are denominational headquarters and multi-site megachurches and broadcasting empires. There's always a temptation for the people of God to build temple complexes that aggregate power to a few, with a whole bunch of regular people working hard and paying their tithes and offerings to create these palaces. And then the benefit for the little people, sometimes it's prosperity gospel, some dangling promise that you might get some of this, but mostly it's reflected glory. See all this, and you're a part of it. See these hanging gardens of Babylon, see this glory of Rome, you're a Roman citizen. So just a little bit of kind of a pride in being a little piece of all that glory. Reflected glory is the carrot for the people. And Jesus and all the prophets are like, that is baloney, that's not nearly enough benefit for the kind of cost that we have to bear.
Okay. Who are we after our encounter with Persia? And I started with this, and I'll just reiterate it. So, big tradition. Jewish rulers handpicked by Persia declare that Cyrus, the emperor, was appointed by Yahweh to exercise divine authority. Therefore, I read this, I guess. To rebel against Jerusalem's leaders is to rebel against the Persian Empire, is to rebel against God. And then, for the people of the land, contend that true worship is not in temple formality, but wherever justice is proclaimed for Yahweh's sake. Worship and imperial rule, not compatible. Okay, Greek Empire. Just going to touch on a few things in these last couple sections, and we'll pick it up next week. So this is 539 to 333 that the Persian Empire has control over Palestine. In 333, Alexander the Great conquers that area. And we're probably somewhat familiar with Alexander. Every empire that we talk about here is the biggest empire to date. And this and this one significantly. This is Alexander's conquest in a very short amount of time. I mean, he went rapidly and conquered all of this area just by conquering all these other empires in the area. So, let's go back again. So, just again, we're here now. Alexander is a student of Aristotle, who is a student of Plato, kind of some of the, you know, great intellectual heirs of the whole Western tradition. And one of the aspects of this, we call it Hellenism, is just like a universalism. Whereas like Persia encourages local rule, Hellenism is our way is ultimately right, and it just kind of swallows up all the other local traditions.
Just Hellas is Greek for Greek.
Yeah.
That's true.
Hellas.
Yeah, just to clarify.
Pastor knows stuff too. One of in what we get in this time with Hellenism, with Alexander, with Greece, is anybody who's not Greek is a barbarian. But you do have an option of coming in and being civilized if we conquer you and you adopt to our ways. So they really try to spread Greek culture, Hellenism, and consider that being civilized, and everybody else is considered barbarians, everybody that resists being conquered and assimilating in the Greek culture.
And the one payoff of that is that unlike other empires, when they conquered you, they knew that they were the winners and you were the losers.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about the Hellenization that Alexander embarked on is Alexander really felt like when he conquered people, he was doing them a favor.
Yeah.
You were ignorant and stupid, and now you get to be Greek, you know, Greek like me.
Supremacy. I mean, like, this sense of supremacy is so, so deep within Greek culture, Hellenism, and it's ultimately justified through military conquest. Might makes right. This is also Rome, Pax Romana. It's peace through conquest. And so, yes, we have to go out and we have to conquer and subdue and all that, but ultimately it is for peace and prosperity for everybody, is the rationale or the thinking in this. Alexander only, he dies in 323, so 10 years later he dies. It was not expected, it happened suddenly, and they weren't ready for a transition in leadership, so there's 20 years of power struggles, and so the massive empire that he had, that you saw on that map, gets split up amongst four different leaders. So from 301 to 198, you see the Ptolemies, and this is Hellenistic or Greek kings in Egypt who are ruling this area. This was not a good time for the people because they did enforce very heavy taxation on the subjects. So there's this time period there, and then there's a shift in 198 to the Seleucids. And the Seleucids are Hellenistic kings up in Syria. So again, these are both Greek empires, but split up amongst four rulers. And so now, at this time period, the Seleucids are ruling. At first, they didn't enforce heavy taxation, and then they overreached in some of their military battles, and they started to struggle financially. Mm-hmm. And then they enforced heavy taxation. So then it was not good for the people. One thing in this time period, to get, there's lots of, let's see, they double down on taxes, strict enforcement, elevation of the high priesthood. So the way that they enforce their heavy taxation is they really elevate the role of the high priesthood. They give them a lot of power. So local rule, again, at the temple, but they give that high priest a lot of power to collect surplus tribute from the people and then keep some of it. What that does is it opens up a lot of skirmishes and fighting for that position of high priesthood. So this time period is complicated because it's just like one person vying for the high priesthood and attacking the other one, and then someone related to that person and attacks the other one. It just goes back and forth. At one point during all this this infighting over the high priesthood, Antiochus IV Epiphanes, who is the king, the emperor at this time period, interprets one of these skirmishes as a revolt. And so he comes into Jerusalem to put this revolt down. And this is an extremely traumatic event for the people. He basically outlaws all the traditional worship. I mean, he kills a lot of the people as he puts it down. He also commits, we read in Daniel, the desolating sacrilege or the abomination of desolation. He slaughters a pig in the temple to profane it, to make it impure, because the purity laws and all of that, knowing what that symbolized for the people. So he totally desecrates the temple at this time period. And so this happens in, what is the date of that? 167 or 8? Shortly after, we have the book of Daniel written. There's not a lot more being written at this time in the Old Testament. Daniel will be the last. Daniel, well, I'll just touch on it briefly. I think you want to understand Daniel. Dana's probably the one to talk to. She's done a lot of work in this area. Actually, this time period is complicated, and Dana is the person to talk to, definitely, about all of this and what's going on. Daniel, first half of Daniel is about, it's about an ancient hero, somebody who was in the courts pretty high up, in first the Babylonian exile, and then Persia, who does well, but is struggling to be faithful in his role in the bureaucracy in Babylon and in Persia. So some of those stories we're familiar with of persecution and struggling to be faithful, because you're always kind of at the changing whims of the king or whoever's in charge at that time. The second half is Daniel looking into the future and interpreting history from the perspective of being in Babylon and Persia. What this does, this is a genre of apocalyptic literature, is it gives a sense that God is ultimately in control of history. Now, the Jewish people at this time period have just been slaughtered again. And there's more, there's also another internal war that breaks out there. So there's a lot of suffering that's going on at this time period. And it gives a sense that it kind of lays out the four beasts or the four kingdoms and Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome. It interprets that all of this is going to take place, but ultimately God is going to be victorious. And not only that, but those who suffer for their faithfulness and those who endure times of persecution, when God is victorious, they're also going to be vindicated. And these people will also be resurrected. Mm-hmm. And so it is Daniel, and all apocalyptic literature is in the context of extreme persecution, extreme suffering, and helps the people see outside of the immediate context where all looks hopeless, to give a sense that ultimately God is in control and we're going to be vindicated. The faithful ones who hold true to the tradition, to the faith, and to the humanity, basically. In fact, Daniel talks about the Son of Man, which is another way of saying it is the human one. It's like the one who keeps his humanity in the midst of a lot of inhumanity.
The humane one.
The humane one, yep. And there's a group of people in Daniel. Oh, just the wise ones, the masculine, I think. Those who are struggling to endure and to be faithful and who see what's going on and are going to hold fast. And Daniel is a part of that school, and they're suffering. And we get a sense that they also experience what 2 Isaiah experienced, the suffering servant enduring for the sake of the people. And so Daniel becomes important in the Gospel of Mark and some of the Gospels because a lot of the way that Jesus is interpreted is through the experience of the people here in Daniel as well.
Okay, those of us who've read Daniel know that the story is set in the middle of the Babylonian captivity when the elites go from Judah or Judea to Babylon, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's 400 years before this was actually written. So for some of us in a certain kind of Christian educational background, that would be scandalous.
Mm.
That Daniel is not actually written about during that time. But for those of us who've grown up with a kind of a literal tradition about the Bible, that might seem deceptive. But in these ancient times, a whole series of literature can come around one person. And stories told through various perspectives about some hero in their culture. So people at that time knew that this story of Daniel was about our time through a popular figure. No one was being fooled at this time. So
yeah.
you get what I'm saying? No one was scandalized at that time about the genre of this literature. And also, this prophecy about the future, the Babylonian Empire, the Persian Empire, was already in the past. The Greek Empire they're in the middle of with the Seleucids. The only thing that's possibly in the future is Rome, but the Roman Republic was already
so
expanding
strong.
All over the Roman Empire. I mean around the Mediterranean. And Daniel is writing this only 100 years before Rome completely takes over that area. That's like saying, that's like me saying probably China will be a great nation about 100 years from now. I mean, a lot of people can make that kind of prediction,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's when it was actually being written.
Thank you. Yeah. This is one of the texts later on in Daniel where you get a sense of what's going on at that time. The abomination that makes desolate, you read about here. He shall seduce with intrigue those who violate the covenant, but the people who are loyal to their God shall stand firm and take action. The wise, the masculine, among the people shall give understanding to many. For some days they shall fall by sword and flame and suffer captivity and plunder. When they fall victim, they shall receive a little help, and many shall join them insincerely. Some of the wise shall fall, so that they might be refined, purified, and cleansed until the time of the end, for there is still an interval until the time appointed. So it's just the emphasis on a people, a remnant, enduring this time for the sake of everybody, and that they will be vindicated by God. Going to the next,
John, quick question. So was Daniel like a real figure in the Babylonian times then? Was he like an actual, or was like a mythological figure fighting against like Babylon or something like that? What was the...
We will never know. I mean, it's possible that there was a real Daniel in Babylonian times that the oral tradition carried forward. So, but we there's no way to know. So it could have been a real figure.
Just a comment on the genre of literature, because this is there's other texts that did not make our Bible, Enoch, First Enoch, and others, apocalyptic literature at this time. There's a lot of it at this time period, and it's literature of resistance to the current order of things. Apocalypsis just means, it means revelation, it also means unveiling. It's helping us see what is actually going on. It's unveiling the propaganda that props up empire, all the levels of obscuring. It's always about what's going on in the present, and at the heart of that worldview is a profound disillusionment with the present order, a sense of political powerlessness, and a conviction that this age is passing away while a new age is being birthed. So there is a sense that this is really awful right now, but this present order is collapsing. It is fading away, and there is something new through our life together that is being birthed, that is humane, that is just, that is like the Jubilee tradition. That is emerging in its midst. So new life is emerging, even in the passing away of the old. This is apocalyptic. The Gospels have a lot of this in it. The Apostle Paul is very apocalyptic in this way. Romans 8 is just a beautiful text about the sons of God and the renewal of creation. That's all apocalyptic literature. And then, of course, the book of Revelation is apocalyptic literature. We do a lot of damage to apocalyptic literature when we try to, like, piece verses together and try to figure out some big puzzle for what it's saying about the future. That's not what's going on. It is talking to the present in that time. Revelation is talking about what's happening in Rome in the 90s AD when it was written. And here Daniel is talking about
You decredited yourself by saying it was prophesying like the 90s. Like 1990.
Oh.
Right, no.
90 AD. That was the rise of Left Behind and all that.
I know.
Also, The Matrix.
The Matrix.
Oh,
yes. Interesting. Yeah.
In Revelation.
The Bible prophesies the future.
All right, who are we after our encounter with Greece? So, some Jewish elites essentially, they're basically secular now. Like, the high priesthood is now pretty much a secular position. Try to curry favor with the Greek rulers for power, prestige, and wealth at the expense of fellow Jews. Whereas in the little tradition, the common people find strength and hope in apocalyptic stories like Daniel and struggle to remain faithful in the face of the sacrilegious Greek rulers. Okay, and we'll touch on this last one now and pick it up next week, because next week we're going to be talking about the Roman context. And there is a brief period here. So we're talking about there's like this, all this struggle for the high priesthood back and forth and all this infighting happening. Well, there is a family, Mattathias and his sons, led by Judas. They're known as the Maccabees, and they kind of emerge. And they're out in the rural areas, and they kind of put together a little guerrilla army out in the country, and they gather a lot of support. And during the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, the one who desolated the temple, they come and they fight a war. And they win against their foreign oppressors. This is the first time that they achieve some measure of independence since pre-Babylonian exile. A long time period. And they're victorious. They frame everything that they're doing as kind of like a zeal for the Torah, all about the temple and the purity of the tradition, and they're very anti-Hellenistic in the way that they talk and what they're all about. In reality, they're mostly just another rival priestly family that finds that a good way to garner support of the people initially. They actually remain very Hellenistic. There's the gymnasium present, which is like the educational center. They keep that intact. All the coinage still has pictures of the Greek rulers at the time. A lot of them have Greek names. I mean, they're Hellenistic through and through, but they use anti-Hellenism as a way to garner the support of some of the people. Isaac?
Maccabees offered to drain the swamp.
Drain the swamp.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
We got Hanukkah out of the deal, so...
Yeah.
I just remember that the Seleucids are 1/4 of the old Greek empire of Alexander. And so they have this little bit of independence, at least the elites got some independence, in the middle of Assyrian, Babylonian, Persian, Greek, Roman.
Mm.
And they have like 100 years of a mini a Jewish empire in the midst of all those.
Mm. Dana?
Yeah. I mean, my understanding, one of the key ways that they're extremely Greek is that they take their priestly family and it is extremely like not like traditional Jewish for a priestly family, like political leadership.
Mm.
So that's like the biggest but a very Greek thing, right?
Yeah.
That there would just be like kind of a mixing of politics and political rulership.
Yeah.
But for the Hasmoneans, it's just a given, and that's one of the big tensions in my understanding of the Hasmonean dynasty.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, so this is confusing. The Maccabees become the Hasmonean dynasty. No, I'm just clear. Yeah, that's what you said. They're really seeking to recreate the Jewish kingdom as it was under Solomon, under Josiah. I mean, they're seeking that sort of rule. Part of what they do is they begin to operate both as high priest and king, and this is kind of what Dana, I think, is alluding to
a little bit as well.
Yeah,
a very Greek culture thing to do.
Right, so they bring those positions together. That compromises the legitimacy of the temple, and they also are pretty brutal in their reign over the people. The stories of these rulers are pretty awful. This is when you get communities out in the desert like the Essenes who are trying to retreat from the wicked priest or the wicked ruler, because they're just like one after another. Their reign is like, it's really brutal. And they're actually still... connected in various ways to the Seleucids and then later to Rome. So it's not completely independent. There's still patronage from the Seleucids even during this time. What happens at the end, and we'll end here tonight, is that two brothers start to get in a fight and a conflict over the high priestly role / king. They're fighting over it. For a while, they kind of have this compromise where one's going to be high priest and one's going to be the king, and then the one who's high priest tries to kind of a coup and tries to take over the kingly position too. So there's a war that breaks out between them, and then they know that Roman general Pompey is close, and so they both reach out to Pompey and ask him, is it Pompey?
No, it's Pompey.
I think it's,
is it?
Yeah, I always thought Pompey too, but
Pompey is a city.
Sounds weird to me to say too.
Oh,
Pompey's
one, I say.
Yeah, I think it's Pompey.
Maybe it's just general non-knowledge about
So they both seek out his help. Aristobulus and Hyrcanus, I think. Is that right? So they both seek out his help, so he comes in to see what's going on and to lend support with his army. But one of them tries to outmaneuver him as he's coming in and makes a bad tactical decision, and he does not appreciate that. So he just totally conquers the city, takes over Palestine, the Roman general in 63, and makes the other one, Hyrcanus, gives him the role of high priesthood. And we'll talk next week about how eventually that leads to Herod the Great as well, and his role. So 63 BCE, the Hasmonean dynasty comes to an end, and Rome has now conquered Palestine. And this is also, there's going to be a Roman civil war that we'll talk about, and it gives rise to, it moves from the Roman Republic to the Roman Empire with the rise of an emperor. But this is a huge shift, and there is a series of really devastating conquests in the decades that follow, up until the birth of Jesus. So in those 60 years, there is just conquest after conquest in the land of Palestine, and often right in Galilee, in the northern part, the former northern kingdom, in the rural areas where there'd be the local shrines, all of that just continually gets smashed. And so the people there endure a lot of trauma at the hands of Rome. And Jesus is born right into the heart of that and is born right into this context. And things, just as a preview, things don't change with the temple as we move forward into Rome. So that's where we'll leave off. Well, actually, anything just to touch on? Okay, we'll talk about the Sadducees, Pharisees, and Essenes next week. Sadducees are aligned during this time period with the temple elite. They're aristocrats. They're very conservative. They don't want any change in the present order. Pharisees are kind of the leaders of the people at this time period. They're more apocalyptic, emphasis on resurrection, about changing the current order. They emphasize table fellowship and purity over temple purity. So they're all about they're trying to bring the tradition to the people in their way. And they pay for it later on. And then the Essenes are those who escaped to the wilderness. You've heard of the Qumran community, the Dead Sea Scrolls. We're still learning more about this community. The Essenes are likely that community in Qumran. And they follow, it's also apocalyptic, and trying to, like all of this stuff, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the high priests, the temple, the Hasmoneans, all of this is a mess, and we're going to retreat, we're going to get out, and we're going to build our own community in a place we were left alone. So different groups like that at this time period. And then the final question is the big tradition and the little tradition. Who are we after our encounter with the Hasmoneans? The Hasmonean dynasty wants to relive the glory of the Solomonic Empire, ultimately about the political and economic power that came with the high priesthood. They sought support from Seleucid and Roman rulers as needed. Sadducees become influential as Jewish elites. Little tradition, Pharisees, Essenes, and other groups emerge as champions of ancient Jewish tradition, of temple purity, and of Jewish culture untainted by Hellenism. So, same struggle, same battle continuing on, and they're both present within the text, and we'll see it reflected when we get to the Gospels. Okay. We went over a few minutes. Let's stop there, and if you have questions, just stick around for a bit, and some of us will stick around to answer it.
I'll just say one thing for next week. So far, the big tradition, little tradition, is kind of, it's not that hard to discern who's the good guys and the bad guys. And then next week, when we talk about the Pharisees, very confusing. Because they're part of the little tradition, but Jesus goes against them.
Well,
Jesus is also against the big tradition, too.
And
so
it's
Jesus,
also,
is by himself, really.
We'll talk
time.
About it, because it's also related to when the Gospels were written down and who the Pharisees were at the time of the Gospels being written and the power that they had.
That's right.
It gets complicated. Some people ask me just for a resource, and there's a number of different ones, but this is just a good introduction. Anthony Ceresco, Intro to the Old Testament, A Liberation Perspective, especially on everything we talked about last week. And a little bit from this week. So if you're looking for a resource, and if you have questions about other things you can't find here, then just talk to me, or Dana, or whoever. So, all right. Can I ask somebody to pray for us? Dana, would you say a prayer for us tonight? Pastor Dana?
Good Lord, good Spirit, we thank you so much for this evening, this chance to come and be together and to study and to learn. Give us hope, Lord, in this time as we watch the news, as we hurt for our brothers and sisters. Empower us, give us clarity of your gospel, of your good news, and help us act in confidence and faith and not in desperation as the people, as Jesus. Come and be with us, O Lord, and thank you so much for this opportunity.
Yeah. And thanks to Laura for the PowerPoint she put together this afternoon. For our next and Marie for dinner again. So.
Thank you, John, for speaking.